You're listening to the Fifth Estate podcast from the Wheeler Centre. In this episode, recorded live on Tuesday, July 10th, 2018, host Sally Warhaft talks to iconic journalist and broadcaster Tracy Spicer about her long career in journalism and the broad contemporary movement against gender discrimination and sexual violence.
Tracy is a reporter, editor, essayist, columnist, trainer, producer, newsreader, presenter, and author. She worked in television, radio, print, and online, and of course will be familiar to you all as a presence in our media lives for quite some time. Her TEDx talk, The Lady Stripped Bare, has had almost 1.5 million views. And if you're not one of those 1.5 million people, just Google it and have a look. It's absolutely wonderful.
I promise I won't be ripping my gear off tonight, though, just in case anyone was questioning that.
Yeah, it was so good. And her memoir, which will be on sale and autographed after this event, is titled The Good Girl Stripped Bare. Tracy's the co-founder and national convener of Women in Media. She has a gong as a member of the Order of Australia, and it's just a pleasure to welcome Tracy Spicer.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
I want to start by asking you about, you know, the sort of your working life, which has been one of this really broad accomplishment. You're successful and you're focused and astute and worldly. Yet I wonder if it surprises you that at this moment in your career you've landed in this particular place, or does it all just make complete sense?
My instinct is to say that's a lovely and generous introduction and I'm humbled by it, but I'm trying to own a lot more things these days as a woman, so thank you for that. In retrospect, it kind of makes sense. I do pinch myself that I've ended up where I have ended up because I grew up in a very low socioeconomic area on the outskirts of Brisbane. I proudly call myself a bogan from Brizzy because my book, as well as being about gender, is about class. But I had a wonderful father who was very passionate about social justice, brought up my sister and I sitting in front of the television. It would go quiet at 6 o'clock at night and my dad would always say, "That's not fair." He'd always support the underdog. So I guess we were brought up with a real sense of trying to make the world a better place. And my mum, even though she never would have called herself a feminist, she really was. She was the first female courier driver in Queensland. And the newspaper in Brisbane, the Courier Mail, greeted this remarkable achievement with the headline, "Who would have thought women can drive after all?" So looking back, I always had a passion for equality, social justice, and trying to affect change from a very early age.
And yet you landed in some ways the most unlikely of careers for this particular change. I mean, being particularly a TV media person, you're forced into worrying about your weight, you're painted with a mask. These are institutions mostly run by powerful, entitled men. I mean, a lot of it reminds me of like the ballet. It's like being a classical ballerina almost, this sort of dance that you have to do. How does that fit, or is this what created it really for you?
That came as a terrible shock to me, and out of the shock I felt galvanised to affect change. The reason I went into television journalism was because you can't be what you can't see, and where I grew up there weren't that many female role models, to be honest. So as soon as I saw Yana Vent on television in the early 1980s, I thought, I want to be her. And I didn't only want to be a journalist or a news and current affairs host, I wanted to be a slight dark-haired woman of Eastern Europe ancestry. I seriously did, because she seems so much more sophisticated than being the bleached-haired, big-titted bogan chick from Dencliffe, okay?
Yeah.
So that's why I went off to do a journalism degree. Thank you, Mr. Whitlam. I never would have been able to afford to go to university if it weren't for that brief moment in history. How about a round of applause? But once I got into my chosen profession, my dream job, it was a series of stick your tits out more, dye your hair, people think blondes are stupid. you know, I want 2 inches off your hair and 2 inches off your ass. The most horrific bullying and belittling and sexual harassment of women I saw around me every day. And I retreated into this shell of being the good girl. Instead of standing up for myself for more than a decade, I just thought, well, this is obviously what women have to put up with in a male-dominated workplace. And to my shame, I was silenced by it.
Hmm. Tell us about some key moments. I mean, obviously, one was when your contract expired at Channel 10. I think you were on maternity leave. Tell us about moments like that in your career, and when you perhaps realised that being a woman, it wasn't a sort of vertical trajectory in the same way as perhaps men.
Yeah, a lot of us put up with these comments, the groping, the grabbing for years and years until we draw a line in the sand and say enough. I'd seen all of my friends either sidelined or sacked once they committed the crime of becoming pregnant and having a child. We'd give going away parties to people when they had children. Women, of course, men were given a pay rise. So when I had my first child and they tried to sideline me, I went up to the meeting with the boss with a pile of papers this high, state legislation, federal legislation, union regulations, and I dumped them on the desk. He said, oh, Trace, you've been away for a while because I had a very premature baby, so I had to take a little bit longer on the maternity leave than was expected. And he said, you've been away for too long. You know, we've got some younger presenters we need to fit in the roster. And I said, what you're suggesting is illegal and immoral, and I will take you to court. And it sounds really cool saying that now, but I was terrified. My hands were shaking under the table. My foot was jiggling, especially when he turned around and said, rightio, lawyers at 10 paces, see you in court. Mm. And then I thought, shit, what have I done? Mm. So I went up to HR. I told them the conversation verbatim, and I was invited back to my old job. That taught me it's worth fighting the good fight. However, it also taught me that when you do fight the good fight, you're likely to end up with a black mark against your name. So the next time I went off on maternity leave, I returned and I was sacked by email. A guy who sat 20 metres across the room sent me an email. That was when I really felt that I had to... Oh, gosh. Look, I had a choice. I could either sign the press release saying I'd chosen to leave for family reasons, which was a lie, or I could take the issue to the federal court and start a national conversation about pregnancy discrimination in the workplace, which still affects 1 in 2 women. I'm really proud that I made that decision. My mum had passed away by that stage, but I reckon she would have been proud as well. I got emails from hundreds of women and men saying the same thing happened to their wife, their daughter, their mother. And this is something we need to talk about. The fact that this is still a plague in our workplaces that sidelines women and contributes to the gender pay gap as well.
Mm. I recently put my toe in the water and ran for public office.
Good on you
Thanks,
for doing that.
Thanks, Tracy. Yes, thank you very much. And I'm really glad I did it. It was a really good experience. But I had a conversation when I was really agonising about whether or not to do it, very close to when I, you know, it actually had to be, a decision had to be made. And I met up with a very powerful man connected to one of the big political parties, just for some advice, somebody that I knew, and I just wanted some advice, and we went out for a drink, and he said to me, you could win this thing, you know, but he said, you're not going to win without $200,000 and you are not going to win with that hair. I said, like, it's my hair. Like, it's not. This is it. You know, I don't do anything. This is how I wake up in the morning, and like, it's clean. You know, but you wouldn't want to see it brushed. And it's my hair. It's who I am. He said, nah, you need $200,000. You need to straighten your hair, and you'll win. And now, I don't think that would have been the 200 grand might have helped. But it was an astonishing and really brutal moment.
Yeah.
I obviously forged ahead with my natural curls and lost. And I've been left contemplating, are we living in a world where it's possible for women, whatever choices they make about what they want to do, to just have a go at being themselves and to be successful?
What you're talking about is so important because it's not just about the hair. For decades, curly hair was kryptonite for women on television. We were not allowed to have curly hair. We're only allowed to now because of Annabelle Crabb. She turned around and insisted on having her natural curls on television. So a round of applause for Annabelle Crabb for changing that.
But it hasn't really changed it.
It hasn't, and that's because for centuries women have been valued for their appearance rather than what's in their hearts or their heads. John Berger, the author, wrote about this in 1972. He said, "Men act and women appear." So there are two choices for us. We either accede to society's strictures and straighten our hair and run for office and know that can be a detriment to us, or we do what you do, which is break the mould and fight the good fight. And I think that's fantastic. Can I tell you something that is probably not going to make you very happy? When a photo promoting this very event went up on my Facebook page this morning, someone commented, a woman commented below and said, "Oh, I thought it was an ad for a straightening cream for my hair. Because you've got the curly hair in the publicity shot and I've got the straightening hair." And I commented, so this is just today, and I commented back, "Actually, we're talking about issues to do with equality and feminism, not hair. You're more than welcome to come along."
Yeah. There you go. Now, obviously, you know, what I've just expressed really connects to your TED Talk, where, you know, you strip it all away and you've remained... I mean, you're not in your shorts and singlet tonight.
Bit chilly.
But you're also not in an uncomfortable dress and stilettos either. It must be incredibly liberating for... I mean, I've never been in a situation in life where I've had to dress the way you had to for TV. I couldn't even... I'd just break my neck, I think, wearing high heels. But what does that feel like? Sort of, you know, halfway through your life to get rid of that?
It's incredibly liberating because when you break down the amount of time and the money that it costs to appear workplace ready or ready for proper society, it really is a burden on women. Now, I understand third wave feminism. A lot of young women come up to me and say, "But I want to wear the stilettos. I feel empowered by it. I want to wear the makeup. I want to do my hair." And I say to them, "That's fine. I get choice feminism. But also understand the history of this, that women have been constrained by corsets, putting lead on their faces for centuries and expected to spend the time and money doing this. So if you do it for yourself and don't embrace that gilded cage," as I think Mary Wollstonecraft once said. And Betty Friedan, of course, wrote so compellingly about the passive consumerism of women, you know, buying cosmetics and lining the pockets of the executives of the pharmaceutical companies who are all men. So there's a real history to do with the cosmetics industry that's very tied up in women's appearance and feminism. It feels really liberating to actually go to a corporate meeting with a big 2-inch hair sticking out of my chin. I really love it, okay? That's not to say I'm unclean. I do groom myself, but I just don't get hung up on that kind of I have to appear in a certain way in a certain circumstance.
Here we are, 2 years since a lawsuit was filed against Fox News chairman Roger Ailes. It's not even 12 months, I realise today. It seems we've been in the post-Harvey Weinstein effect for a lot longer than almost 10 months, be a year in October, catapulted into Me Too. I wonder what you think, what was it about Harvey Weinstein, about that man, that particular man in that moment of time?
It was the perfect storm because he had fame and he had power, so he had a long way to fall. There were also women who had the powerful and privileged position of having a voice and an international profile to be able to speak out against him and in that way open the door, and again there's complexity around this as well, for a whole bunch of other women around the world to speak out. Now, we all know that sexual harassment and indecent assault in the workplace or society disproportionately affects marginalised communities, okay? And these are people who have even less agency and power and voice. But at least it opens the doors to these conversations and for structural changes to happen in society. A lot of people are engaged in a bit of a backlash against Time's Up at the moment, and I understand that, saying, oh, but this is just for privileged women in Hollywood. It's not. What we're trying to do now is to bring this movement to everyone, because we know that people on the factory floor and in retail jobs and in hospitality are really badly affected by sexual harassment. I think one of the unions found that 9 out of 10 hospitality workers have been groped or grabbed, either by a customer or a manager. This is where the conversation needs to go now.
There are lots of divisions, aren't there, in Me Too? There's a lot of angst and some nastiness. There's, you know, men pitted against women and women pitted against other women and elites and ordinary people. And does it... I mean, I'm very excited about it. I think a lot of people are. But I wonder how precarious the whole movement is. You know, in 10, 15 years' time, are we just going to be looking back at a lot of noise that happened around Harvey Weinstein?
No, is the very short answer to that. If you look at the history of feminism, it comes in bursts. There are always divisions. Remember the suffragettes in the UK, when they got the vote for women, they only got the vote for women with property. There were divisions in that movement, fierce divisions, and a lot of anger that the vote wasn't achieved for all women until many, many years later. I think it's healthy that there's conversation and debate about this. And I also know by understanding the lessons of history that we are making huge advances at the moment. We can feel the ground shifting beneath our feet. Certainly there'll be backlash. There's a bit of backlash at the moment. There'll be more to come undoubtedly. Because when you shift power in society, there's a lot of people who aren't going to like that, and there's a lot of people who are going to fight against it.
Tell us what you think about how it's playing out in Australia uniquely. So a very blokey, matey and very conservative culture. What are you seeing that's particular to Australia?
You've articulated that beautifully, and I think you read my mind, because on top of that, and I don't think anyone can debate that characterisation of this country's history, we also have some of the toughest defamation laws in the world. When I sent out my tweet in October saying I was investigating two men, and one of those men was Don Burke, that was who I had in mind, I knew that this would be an uphill battle. That's why I got the ABC and Fairfax together, two investigative teams, two sets of lawyers, two sets of protection. It's incredibly hard to do one of these stories because our defamation laws act to protect the wealthy and powerful. There's no doubt about that. We don't have First Amendment protections like they do in the United States. And we've got this very conservative, blokey, uber-masculine history to our country. We're moving much more slowly than the States. But in a way, I'm a glass half full kind of gal. In a way, that's good because we're moving safely. And judging by the conversations I'm having at all levels, at the community sector when it comes to sexual assault centres, at a boardroom level and at a government level, people are taking this seriously. There's structural change happening at the moment that will protect people in the next generation. It's just happening really slowly.
I sort of, if we reflect on some of the local things aside from Don Burke, in Melbourne, of course, we've had the saga with Robert Doyle, which has been the biggest political scalp so far in Australia. And the subsequent investigation and the Freckleton report and a real tension and a really important question about rights to information. So at this stage, the only people that have read the Freckleton report, I think, are men, and where the perpetrator has been able to read it, but the people, the victims of it, have not. Now, this is it is complicated in terms of, promises of confidentiality and so on, but they're the basic facts of it. And those questions are just dangling there, a real sense I have that just people just want them to go away. And in Australia, there's often a kind of culture where it just does go away. You leave it long enough and people will just kind of forget about it. But that at the end of this story, you have three women who, you know, it was just a shocking experience in their lives going public about it. So, you know, that's one incident, and there's something to me very Australian about the lack of resolution in it and this just going away. We have the current Sarah Hanson-Young and David Lyonholm issue, and I think it looks like she's going to push for defamation. But again, in the context of what's going on with Me Too, very, very complicated because her defence will be one of connected to this idea of slut shaming, and therefore, you know, as a feminist, she wants to defend obviously this outrageous comments. But to do that, she's going to have to be saying, "I'm not the person you describe me as." But what would be wrong with that if she was?
It's a really good point. So it'll end up being a conversation around sexual agency as well. That's why I think it's a really interesting case. In answer to your first contention with regards to Robert Doyle, I had a very interesting conversation with Tessa Sullivan around about the time that she found out she wasn't going to be able to have a look at the Freckleton report. I've now received 2,000 disclosures from women and a handful from men, actually, in all industries. And one thing that stands out is their absolute feeling of disempowerment when this happens. And the fact that 50% of them did try to complain, did try to do something. And what Tessa expressed to me was that absolute disempowerment that I've taken all this action and I still can't even look at the independent report. That is a real issue that needs to be looked at. And hopefully this national inquiry into sexual harassment in the workplace has terms of reference that are wide enough that look at these things, that look at the statute of limitations. Because I don't know how many of you know this, but if you want to put in a complaint to the Human Rights and Equal Opportunities Commission, dependent upon which state or territory you're in, you have to do it within 6 months to a year. Certainly, you can be given an exemption by the particular commissioner, but usually you've got to do it really quickly. Now, I've got women contacting me who were indecently assaulted in the workplace when they were 16, and they are 73 now when they finally build up the confidence to contact me. So these are the levers, the policies and procedures we have to look at.
The other sort of one that popped into my mind was the Prime Minister's response to the Barnaby Joyce saga. And obviously this is not a Me Too issue, but it is an issue about the way the most powerful man in Australia is responding to people's, you know, very personal issues and coming out with a ban on sexual relations in the office, which, honest to God, you know, if you work in politics, I don't know where else you're meant to meet anyone.
Or journalism
for that matter. But this sort of moralising, there are subtleties and complexities in all of these stories that I just feel like Australia has not shown any evidence of being up to sorting through at the sort of structural levels.
It was such a ludicrous response from the Prime Minister, because we all know that sexual harassment is not necessarily about sex, it's about power. The industries where we see the most sexual harassment is where you see a lot of men in leadership positions and a lot of women in lower paid, lower power roles. I met my husband in the workplace. He's a cameraman, I'm a journalist. Very uncommon, I know.
Very yarn event.
Very yarn event, in fact. And, you know, that whole idea of we have to ban office relationships, oh, no one's allowed to flirt anymore, oh, I can't say that someone's got a nice dress on, it's actually just a straw man argument. It's a sideline. It's trying to detract us from debating the real issues, which are these huge power imbalances.
So what for you are the most problematic sort of flaws of Me Too?
Oh, that's a really good question. I mean, like with any movement that has built so quickly, I think there's a lot of them. I would have to say that one of the great flaws internationally and in Australia is that we haven't brought everyone along with us quickly enough. There are a lot of women who contact me, women with disabilities or women of colour, who say, I don't see a lot of stories about people like me who are affected in the workplace. So I do think we have failed to a degree to bring everyone along with us, the most disempowered people in our community. And that's a combination of things. You know, one of the reasons being that it's all moved along so quickly. And the media tends to focus, I mean, with these 2000 disclosures, I'm pitching stories to the media all the time. The next ones that we're doing, I'm doing with the Saturday Paper, as well as The Guardian, as well as News Corp. There's a lot of stories on the boil. The media is flawed, and it wants stories about powerful, high-profile people, not necessarily disadvantaged people. So that's where we need to look now.
And how do you do that?
I've got really good stories like that that have started coming in that I want to focus on now, and I've just got to keep pitching them and pitching them until they run them, I figure.
Mm. And I mean, this is, you know, in I guess the most obvious question about determining when there's enough evidence and where the bar is. So, in Australian examples, you've got, you know, Dombert Burke, seems pretty clear. But you then have men that are going through the courts, Craig McLaughlin and Jeffrey Rush again, where these are three very different stories. Where's the line? How did you know with Don Burke when you knew you were safely on the right side of it?
Oh, that's easy. You've got to prosecute it like you're in the courts. You not only have to have physical evidence, so, for example, emails, photographs, timelines, screenshots. And when I say evidence, and this is really breaking it down, with Don Burke we spoke to about 60 to 70 people, and then we spoke to their friends and their family and who they told at the time and built a timeline. And then we had to get them to say, if this goes to court, will you testify? And we had to get them to sign stat decks. And then that was run through two sets of lawyers. So this is the extent you have to go to, almost prosecuting it as if you're a lawyer.
And how do you do that on behalf of women that are not involved in a story with a figure like him, where it is an everyday anonymous kind of setting?
You have to go through the same process, but it's harder because these high-profile people they're very well known, obviously, so people are going to come forward about them. But with a lot of people in other workplaces, I've only got, say, one, two, maybe three people who've come forward about that one person. So I can't do stories on those people. And that's where it's incredibly difficult with our defamation laws. I can certainly connect them with lawyers or counselling services, which is what I've done with every person who's disclosed to me. Do you know what, though? The vast majority of people who've contacted me have said, look, I don't want you to do anything. I just wanted to tell someone and I wanted to be believed. It's a process of catharsis. One woman who I met a couple of weeks ago actually in Sydney's West, she's 70 and she had a terrible incident in a bakery when she was just 16 years old. It scarred her entire life. I said, what do you want? She said, I want to sit in a room with this man if he's still alive. If he's still alive, he'll be in his 80s or 90s. And she said, I want to say to him how he's ruined my life. So there's a lot of this conversation around some kind of restorative justice that doesn't involve any kind of journalistic investigation.
Mm. What have you learned about our legal system?
I've learned that it's incredibly flawed. Mm. I mean, we had a legal roundtable through Now Australia, which is the not-for-profit that we set up to try to help people in every industry. And lawyers just said, look, a lot of the Our legal system has not kept up with society's mores and with problems in the workplace, and in fact with women even being in the workplace in such large numbers as they are, but that's a whole other discussion. The payouts for sexual harassment are incredibly low, even though people suffer PTSD for the rest of their lives. I don't think people actually really took into account in our legal system how much this damages people. There's a statute of limitations issue. There's a whole bunch of things we need to look at in both the criminal system and the civil system. If you're interested in the criminal system, you should read the book by Bree Lee, Eggshell Skull, which is amazing. She's a young lawyer who takes her case to court when she was sexually assaulted as a 12-year-old, and she breaks down a lot of the problems in the Queensland criminal system. So we need lawyers who are confident enough and strong enough to lobby and speak out about the problems in our legal system at the moment.
Mm. What have you learned about men that you didn't know 10 years ago through these, not about the behaviour that is connected to Me Too, but about the desire of many men that is exactly the same as the desire of women for the kind of world we'd like to live in, who feel displaced or uncertain of their role, which is huge, in this movement.
I learned about the code of mateship. I've been reading a lot of Dr. Michael Flood. He's an amazing researcher from Queensland in this area of masculinity and particularly toxic masculinity. A lot of men I've spoken to really want to help out, really good men, want to be great bystanders, want to be good allies in this movement. But so many feel silenced by the code of mateship. Let me give you a really strong example of that. When we were doing the Don Burke story, I spoke to a lot of men who I've known for years, right? Camera operators, researchers, producers, who said, oh, look, you know, he was a bully. He was a bully to a lot of men as well as sexually harassing women. And I said, well, can you please talk on camera about this? That would really help the women who are putting themselves on the line to go on camera and talk about this. They said, oh, no, I couldn't. You know, I couldn't speak out at the time and I couldn't speak out now because that's just not what you do as a bloke. So I started thinking about this code of mateship that silences men. That means when a lot of men see women being sexually harassed, they're frightened about speaking out because they might be speaking out against other men, and that makes them feel uncomfortable and that they might be targeted. So what I want to do now, and I've done a lot of interviews with places like Triple M, I've written columns for GQ magazine, I want to talk to men about this code of mateship, because toxic masculinity in a patriarchal culture is not only not good for women, it's not good for men as well. So giving men the tools to speak out, I think, is also the next step in this movement. Mm. And that's the other flaw of this movement. I don't think we've brought men along as well as we could have. There's been a lot of backlash, but just in the last month, I've spoken to really, really blokey conservative men. I live in Tony Abbott's electorate, after all, at barbecues, who've said, you know, we really love what you and other women are doing for this Me Too movement. It's great for our daughters. It's great for our granddaughters. So I can see change at the grassroots happening.
In your TED Talk and your written work, you say to women, you know, you can change things. You don't have to change everything all at once. You don't have to strip down your undies and go to work in your flats without your makeup on. If that's, you know, you can do things bit by bit. It got me thinking about, you know, things I loathe, like not life-changing things, but just things that just really irritate me that, you know, if you could just sort of yell loud enough, they might stop. And one of them, like a particular bugbear of mine, is when something awful happens to a woman and you see or a girl, a child particularly, and you see politicians get up and say, as the father of a daughter, right? So, like, using their little girls for their own, you know, growth of moral stance in whatever goddamn universe they're inhabiting, it just really, really, really makes me cross. What makes you cross like that?
Oh, how long have you got? Oh,
we've got actually, very good question. Segue to Jose. First time ever, 7 years of Fit the State. Oh, the clock just came on. Thank you very much. We've got 25 minutes.
Sally, this might not be a popular opinion in this room, and I understand what you're saying about the daughter thing, but I am at heart a pragmatist. I don't think it's right that men are only on board if they have a daughter or a granddaughter.
Exactly.
But do you know what?
Yeah.
If that's what it takes to get people across the line, I ain't going to be complaining too loudly, because I'm interested in the language of influence and I'm interested in the levers of power. Different people are influenced by different things. For example, and this is why the Me Too movement is so powerful, storytelling is what changes hearts and minds. We can look at data until we're blue in the face, and we need data to back things up. But it is the anecdotes that we tell the men around us. You know, a lot of men in the media have said to me, gosh, I didn't think there was much to this Me Too thing until one of my colleagues came up and said this has happened to her, and I didn't realise, she seemed like a tough bird. I didn't think that that would, you know, worry her or whatever. And I kind of internally roll my eyes. But whatever it takes to get people over the line, I think that's great. I'll tell you what infuriates me more. Who here has seen the sexual violence pyramid? Or knows of the sexual violence pyramid, please promise me you'll Google it when you get home. It is what causes all these problems, okay? So on the wide base of the pyramid are sexist and bigoted attitudes. On the next level of the pyramid are sexist and bigoted jokes and words. Above that is the groping and the grabbing. Above that is the sexual assault and the rape. And above that is homicide, okay? So what infuriates me is when people say, oh, well, it was just a joke. It meant nothing. It does not mean nothing. By accepting and laughing at those sexist jokes in the workplace or society, any of us are supporting the serial predators and murderers at the top of that pyramid. That's what infuriates me.
I think there's more optimism for your fury than mine, actually, because I feel like that's actually something that is changing a bit. I feel like it might be, but I'm a bit afraid to be too optimistic. I mean, it does feel like in the past nearly, you know, 12 months, something in that has shifted. In fact, a really wrenching example here in Melbourne was the murder of Eurydice Dixon, and a response by the police, which, you know, there was a murderer on the loose. The police said, be careful. At any other moment in time in this country or any other, that would have been a pretty reasonable thing to say. But it was grabbed onto so quickly and so movingly, and in fact I thought the police's response was just absolutely fantastic and incredibly moving. And I felt that was a real sort of moment where in that kind of a situation something like that was reversed and apologised for. That made me think, wow, you know, that just would not have happened. Well, we know that it didn't happen in the years preceding with any other such horrific incident. So
I agree with you entirely. And the most important thing about what the police did there was they opened a conversation for people in their lounge rooms about what was acceptable as a response to something as horrific as that. In our own lounge room, I've got a boy and a girl, 12 and 13 years of age, and my husband and I talked about it. Now, my husband's pretty on board with this stuff, but he said to me, I don't understand what's wrong with saying to our 12-year-old daughter when you go out at night, be careful. And that opened up a conversation for me to say, but why wouldn't we say that to our 13-year-old son as well, rather than make it a gendered thing? It was only when I said to him, do you realise, Jace, that for my whole life, I'm 51 years of age, I've walked in the dark with my keys between two fingers. And I said to him, you don't have to do that, do you? And he said, no. That's where storytelling in the lounge room is really important.
And that was a huge conversation. I had the same conversation in my home, also with a son and daughter. Although they're only three, so I've got it. I got a bit of time for this one to sink in, you know. I'm really, you know, Australia can be slow, but it can't be that slow. all of this, of course, is going to be meaning not very much while women continue to be paid less, while women continue to be responsible for a ridiculous share of domestic drudgery, a conversation that's been going on way longer, and yet it hasn't changed. We're having all these conversations about women, and yet the two most basic things, how we live at home and how we work, haven't changed. So how do we align those things with Me Too?
Oh, it's all linked. And the way we align them is to have those conversations, those hard conversations at home with our partners, if we have a partner and particularly if we have children, because that's where it starts. I have friends who won't have those conversations with their partners because they say, if I open the floodgates on that, that's going to be the end of our marriage. That's going to end in divorce. And yet that's the role modelling that their children are seeing. You know, the mother working and doing all the unpaid work around the house, and this is what the kids are being brought up with. So unless we have those hard conversations, and it's kind of unfair that women have to also do that unpaid work of having those conversations. Mm. I would much rather see, you know, powerful men shaking this up.
I mean, I totally get, though, why men wouldn't want to give this game up. It'd be so great, wouldn't it? Just to be paid more and do less housework. It's a pretty good gig.
Well, look at your three-year-olds when they're in a sandpit. No one wants to give up the toys.
Yeah, that's right. You know, I don't feel like the same momentum is there with that because it's kind of boring. Mm. You know, there's nothing new to say. No one could compose a tweet that was interesting really about, you know, that. So how do you make it interesting again?
I would disagree. I think there's a lot of really good humorists who are writing about this stuff at the moment. Who's read the Caitlin Moran books? She's a UK columnist and humorist. She writes really engagingly about this stuff. I think there's some fantastic cartoons about it. I do think that we're at the stage where we're laughing about it and talking about it. We've just got to get to the next stage of change being affected. Mm. And if it's going to be affected, it'll happen now. This is a huge wave of feminism, and we can't see how big it is because we're right in the middle of it.
If you would like to ask a question to Tracy, just put up your hand and one of our wonderful ushers will, if they put a microphone in it, then you can begin to talk.
Feel free to ask me anything. I'm very indiscreet.
Hi. Thanks very much for the interesting conversation. I'm really interested in your comments around the pyramid of sexual harassment leading up to rape at the top. And I feel like I've had so many of those conversations with people in my life over the last many years, but also in particular the last couple of months. And I'm wondering what you think the big change needs to be to see the kind of shift in violence against women, like we saw around the King Hits being rebranded to Coward Punches, which the media had a huge role to play in, and then having lockout laws in Sydney, which essentially was because of the death of some young men. How do we get that same kind of serious cultural societal shift for violence against women? Because I just kind of feel like I don't really know what else to do.
Thank you for everything that you have done and that you are doing. Never underestimate the power of one person. I did a documentary in Uganda on one woman who changed the domestic violence laws there. She was a survivor and she lived in a rural and regional area that was 3 hours out of Kampala. So if that woman, Jennifer, can change the laws in that country, every one of us in this room can affect enormous change. I would venture to say that we're seeing great change around that at the moment, and a lot of it's being driven by organisations like Our Watch when it comes to the language. Just to compare it with regards to the King Hit thing, I think it's a really great parallel to draw. I like it when we have conversations about domestic violence being domestic terrorism. And I think we need to look at the language around sexual harassment and indecent assault and rape as well. What we're seeing that's positive at the moment is the way the media is responding to this kind of stuff. We're finally seeing the tabloids getting on board with putting the blame where it lies and not always calling the guy who kills the family a good bloke. I know we saw that in WA a couple of months ago. That was horrific. But just in the last couple of weeks, I've seen much more responsible reporting, even by the tabloids. So we're seeing a great shift there at the moment.
Look, I don't want to be the curly-haired downer on this stage. But I would say we've also in the last couple of weeks had a murder story where I noticed the man was named and the woman, a 16-year-old girl, was the girl in the barrel.
Oh, yes.
You know?
Terrible.
So terrible. I sort of, I'm not as taken on that change being as pervasive as, you know.
But that's also the confluence of the laws in that state and the media reporting of it. That's why we need, and that's where Our Watch is doing a great job, the overarching response. You're absolutely right. But again, I'm optimistic in this area because I see a desire on the behalf of editors to change this, driven largely by the incredible work of Jane Gilmore down here. She has done more than anybody in changing that language.
Hi, Tracy. I was caught by the comment of the woman who was assaulted in her bakery, in her workplace, and she said, he ruined my life, or, you know. So the whole idea that she was 70 or and she was
70.
Declaring that, and that's the way she feels looking back. So the question that I had is, you've spoken or heard from 2,000 people who've come forward with their stories. That's really traumatic to be 70 and remembering what happened when you were 16 and for it to ruin your life. What have you heard about all of these women who've come forward who are moving away from victimology to survivors? What is the strategies that they've put into place? What are the answers for them to hold their head up high?
So many of them have actually moved into working in the sexual assault sector to help others, and a lot of them have found that incredibly cathartic. By being able to share their stories and help others, that is what has helped them survive, whether that's by helping someone else in the workplace or do it in the formal sector or in the not-for-profit sector. The vast majority of people who are helping us volunteer for Now Australia are survivors of indecent assault or sexual harassment. So by being able to turn their tragedy into something positive for somebody else, that's been really powerful. A lot of them have gone on and studied stuff like journalism or law and then worked in that particular area, and I find that really encouraging and inspiring. But honestly, to go back to what I said earlier, the most empowering thing for a lot of the women who've contacted me is purely to articulate that this happened to them and to have someone bear witness to that.
It's so difficult though, isn't it, for women who want to take the next step and get something more than a conversation in a room, when for the vast majority, all you hear is, I kind of wish I hadn't gone down that path. Mm. There's something of a sort of the shameful whistleblower or, you know, where it just doesn't go well. And for those women who want to be able to do it and stay in the job that they're in and just be able to do their job, how do we figure that out about supporting women so they, you know, this happened and this is what I want to happen because of it, and then I just want to get back to work?
There's a lot of practical things we can do in the workplace. There's a lot of best practice around the world, but I'll leave that to the lawyers and the executives and the inquiry to deal with. What I'm more interested in is the transferal of the concept of shame. Most people who've contacted me say, I feel so ashamed, either that this happened, they blame themselves, or that they complained to a certain level but never took it earlier and they feel that they didn't fight the good fight enough for their female colleagues. There's all this internalising of shame. What we're seeing at the moment is that shame being shifted to where it should rightly lie, and that is with the perpetrator and the people who covered it up. The conversations I'm hearing around board tables and at an executive level are conversations of shame, conversations out of the mouths of power brokers saying, I'm ashamed that I didn't do anything about this earlier. So what I would say to women who are feeling ashamed, feeling that they don't want to speak out is, speak out, it's incredibly cathartic, and put the shame where it belongs, on the perpetrators and the protectors.
Mm. Yes, hello. Before Harvey Weinstein was prosecuted, Meryl Streep called him a god. Is Hollywood hypocritical?
Oh, very pointed question. I think that, oh gosh, there are always going to be people who protect perpetrators. I don't want to point the finger at someone, that person that you've named, because I don't know whether she knew what Harvey Weinstein was doing or whether she didn't know. I'm not across Hollywood enough to be able to mention that. It brings up a really interesting area, though, about the creation of art. And I know there's been this discussion for a long time around someone like Woody Allen. You know, people have asked me at gatherings like this, should I boycott Woody Allen films, or should I not consume the work of, you know, Juno Diaz, because he was accused of sexual harassment, you know, the author. And I would say, do what you want, take whatever boycott you want in your own life. I certainly would not want to watch a product that's been produced by someone who's a serial sex predator. And I think probably the best way to stop people doing things is by hitting them in the hip pocket and boycotting their work.
Mm. One of the things that interests me all the way along with all these conversations is that, do you think there's a fundamental misunderstanding of the men and people in general, but men in particular, of the impact of what they're doing? I'm 60 years old. I grew up in an environment where, boy, you know, some of the things you saw as a teenager and beyond, nobody really seemed to understand it. Do you think that's part of the problem?
I think that is a huge part of the problem, and you've articulated that magnificently, because if you extrapolate that to look at policing, our legal system, our politics, you've got a lot of people making decisions who are generally older men who have never experienced this kind of stuff and in no way can understand the impact that it can have on a girl or a woman for the rest of her life. And that's part of the reason why our legislation is so far behind. I write in my book, it's a comedy book, because I do think the best way of changing hearts and minds is through humour, but I write about being sexually assaulted as a 14-year-old on my first job behind the Yummies bar at the roller skating rink in Dedcliffe on the outskirts of Brisbane. And a guy grabbed me and kissed me so hard I could taste blood. It was disgusting. But he probably went off, and I know what you're talking about is different. It's more, you know, language around this kind of stuff. But he probably didn't think about that again for his whole life, yet I will never, ever forget that happening to me at 14. And I don't know many 14-year-old boys who would go through something like that in their first job. So you really can't understand this kind of thing unless you've been through it or seen it happen.
Mm. And even at that much more subtle level, if you just paid less or doing more or walking around, as I also have all my life, with the key in the hand.
That's right, or being told, you know, your hair's too curly for politics, or in my case, your bum's too big for television, and then you internalising that misogyny and thinking that about yourself for the rest of your life.
Mm. Thank you for all your wise words this evening, Tracy. I'm a criminal lawyer and I participated in the Now Legal Roundtable, and I share your concerns about the state of defamation law and criminal law in this country, but I think there's also a secondary danger with the way that that kind of strict legal language is infused into our daily conversations about this topic. it's quite one thing for, as a journalist, having to be satisfied of an allegation to a court standard, but one of the reasons why women don't speak out is because they don't know if what happened to them constitutes sexual harassment or sexual assault, and they fear ruining somebody's life through an allegation. And that has come about as a result of the fact that we're obsessed with due process outside of the courtroom. So I'm wondering what you have to say about the way that we can make it easier for women to just talk about this without even going yet to the sort of legal standard you might have to meet if you ever go to a courtroom or to a news agency.
Thank you for coming to our legal roundtable and for sharing your wisdom, because I'm a journalist and legal processes are often beyond me, aside from the little bit of investigative journalism I've had experience with. You are absolutely right, and I'll answer that by way of anecdote. I am an ambassador for the Full Stop Foundation, which is run by Karen Willis, one of the most incredibly powerful women in the sexual assault sector since, gosh, the 1960s. She's been extraordinary. I was talking to her about some of those instances in the workplace that I share in my book, calling them sexual harassment. She said, "That's not sexual harassment. You've been indecently assaulted." And I did not know the right language. I didn't even know what had happened to me. And a lot of the women who contact me say the same thing. They say, "I don't know where to go with this. I don't know what this was. I can't really articulate what happened to me, but this is what happened to me, and can you point me in the right direction?" We do need to simplify the language around this so women feel somehow empowered to speak out and do something, because they are lost and they are confused. You're absolutely right.
Are you finding that younger women have a different take on this?
Yes, and I find as well as that older women, my age and older, seem to be very split into two distinct camps. I feel that there's a lot of tremendous support from third and fourth wave feminists. I'm very inspired by the next generation. There's a lot of support by some older women who say, "Thank goodness that we're talking about this and doing something. This happened to me my whole life. It was so wrong." But there's also some older women who say, "Gosh, that's just the way it was. I stood up for myself. Why can't everyone else stand up for themselves?" And I know that infuriates a lot of young women, because they think, "Gosh, I would hope that my elders would want to make life better for me rather than saying that's just what you've got to put up with." However, equally, I understand the women in the workplace and the generation ahead of me. Often there was only a handful of women in the workplace, and they just had to kind of toughen up, ally with the patriarchy just to get ahead. So I see it from all points of view. It's very complex. Mm.
Tracy, on the question of language, the use of domestic violence for murder. Murder is horrific, whether it's in a park or at home. Is this helpful to keep using this qualifier?
Yeah, we need to change the language around that. When I worked down here for 3AW, which I think was about 25, 27 years ago now, I was a police reporter and I had a scanner next to my bed. I kept hearing...
Back in the day, sorry to interrupt, when they employed women, 3AW, that's...
Yes, that is exactly right, sister. It is quite a shame that there aren't more female voices on
sorry
that station
to
in
interrupt.
2018.
Yeah.
So true. Mm. I heard on the scanner next to my bed this code 10, code 10. I said to the boss, "What is a code 10 and why don't we ever cover it?" He said, "Oh, that's just domestic violence. It's some guy giving his wife the back of his hand. What goes on behind closed doors stays there. It's a private matter." And it was such a stain on society and our industry at that time that none of us questioned that. That could have happened on Fitzroy Street, St Kilda, and it would lead the bulletin. But because it happened behind closed doors, it was like the tree that fell in the forest. Did anybody hear? Part of that reason, I think, is because of that word domestic. It's just a domestic. That was used all the time, all those decades ago. We need to look at the language around it. I agree entirely.
Do you have any suggestions?
I don't, but I know that Our Watch is best placed to do that, because they are doing the robust research that we need to look at to change the language.
It is a fascinating conversation, Tracy, and I congratulate you, and I'm, you know, inspired by you seizing this at, you know, at this moment in your career and your life, and I just can't wait to see how it all pans out. I mean, I think it is going to be better. I do, and I think it's step by step, isn't it? Even when we want some leaps and bounds. But it really is great to have your optimism and the incredibly hard work that you bring to this. So great to have a bit of an extended question time and terrific questions tonight. And we'll see you all again soon. Thank you, Tracy Spicer.
Thank you, Sally.
Tracy Spicer with host Sally Warhaft for The Fifth Estate, recorded live at the Wheeler Centre in Melbourne. If you're a regular listener, you'll know that WheelerCentre.com is the place to go for videos of these conversations, as well as more than 100 other episodes from this series, plus upcoming events and an archive of thousands of conversations and articles. And if you'd like to be in the audience when we record The Fifth Estate, you'll find tickets there too. Until next time, take care.